Our guest this evening is Donna Jackson Nakazawa, author of the new book, The Autoimmune Epidemic, Bodies Gone Haywire in a World Out of Balance, and the cutting-edge science that promises hope. Our program tonight is made possible in part by your membership support and our co-sponsors, BuffaloRising.com and iCare and Vision Associates. WBFO's Meet the Author series is funded by a grant from the New York Council for the Humanities. And I also want to take this opportunity to thank Joe Gardella, chemistry professor at the University at Buffalo, for first making me aware of Donna's book and for helping to arrange tonight's visit. The occurrence of autoimmune disease is increasing at an uncomfortable rate, a rate that I wasn't even aware of until I had read Donna's book. In fact, shortly after finishing The Autoimmune Epidemic, I was at a function talking about the book to a group of 15 people. I told them that if estimates are accurate, one of us in that group would come down soon with an autoimmune disease. As it turned out, two people in the group already suffered from autoimmunity. Now, there are numerous factors that could be contributing to this spike, but increasingly research is pointing to environmental contamination as the obvious culprit. As an exercise, Donna asks her readers to visit the EPA's website. Type in their zip code and watch the screen materialize with sites that might be laced with hazardous, toxic, or Superfund classified chemicals. One Eastside neighborhood, right here in Buffalo, in fact, is so polluted that Donna writes you might blink twice to think how foolhardy it would be for anyone to live there. It's just that toxic. We're going to talk more about that neighborhood a little later this evening. But to explore that website is also to realize the difficulty in avoiding environmental contamination. Aside from what's buried, abandoned, or being emitted, there's also the reality that our everyday existence puts us in contact with substances that could be contributing to the rise in autoimmune diseases. The exposure may be small, but small, as we will learn, may be enough. In the final analysis, our daily routines might be a giant experiment that one day reveals the dangers which today remain cloaked. Slowly, however, strides are being made as scientific advances reveal the processes that are responsible for these diseases, and also as science reveals revolutionary new treatments as well. I hope you'll join me now in welcoming our Meet the Author guest to WBFO and to the University at Buffalo. Please say hi to Donna Jackson Nakazawa. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. So nice to be here.
Donna, to open the show, could I ask you please to read from the introduction of the new book?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to do it. This book is about a global health epidemic that threatens to affect each and every one of us. However, the seeds for this book were sown in my own health crisis. Like 23.5 million other Americans, I suffer from autoimmune disease, and it has ravaged my life, placing before me the greatest obstacles I have ever known. Pages of this book were written during different stays in the small white hospital rooms of Johns Hopkins Hospital, and many chapters were drafted during long bedridden months at home. The greatest of these challenges began one fine spring afternoon as I was celebrating Carpet Day with my daughter. Carpet Day is our own personal mother-child holiday celebrated only by us. On the first great spring day, we take an old carpet and unroll it on our suburban drive. We bring pillows, chalk, snacks, and lemonade and lie there, reading and chatting, pretending it's the beach for a whole afternoon. On Carpet Day, you can almost hear the seagulls and feel the breeze of the ocean waves that we still won't visit for months. That day, we brought our golden retriever puppy outside with us. He saw a squirrel and off he went. I bounded after him, or tried to, only to find that my left leg wouldn't follow my right. I hurtled headlong into the grass. Over the next 72 hours, my left leg, then my right, then both arms lost all muscle control as my body underwent what was, for me, the all-too-familiar creeping paralysis of Guillain-Barré syndrome, an autoimmune illness in which the nerves, myelin sheaths are destroyed by the body's own immune system. Within 24 hours, my breathing became shallow and short. It was clear I was facing something far more than a minor back problem, which I had hoped it would be. I was admitted to Hopkins, where the neurologist who took my case ordered infusions of immunoglobulin or other people's healthy immune cells, the standard treatment for GBS. In many first-time cases, but not all, GBS paralysis is 90% reversible with treatment, and the myelin sheaths begin to regenerate. It is a remarkable process. If left untreated, GBS can be fatal. The paralysis spreads to the lungs, and patients require intubation, a tube inserted into the airway to prevent them from suffocating to death. In 2001, I recovered well with immunoglobulin treatments, followed by months of physical therapy. Although I was left with strange neurological bells and whistles, jingly nerve endings, tired, locked muscles, twitchy connections, it seemed a minuscule price to pay for being able to walk unassisted again. I was so very fortunate. Still, other problems emerged. I was told that I also had leukopenia, a dangerously low white blood cell count. Leukopenia and GBS came on the heels of two other autoimmune diagnoses that had spanned the previous 15 years. Small fiber sensory neuropathy, which leads to a permanent loss of some of the normal sensation in the hands and feet, and hypothyroidism, or an underactive thyroid. In addition, I suffered from vasovagal syncope, a feigning and seizure disorder caused by the heart sending incorrect signals from the brain to the vagus nerve and failing to pump enough blood through the body, cured by doctors surgically implanting a pacemaker when I was 28. In recovering from Guillain-Barré syndrome, back home, physical therapy, meditation, and an autoimmune preventative diet all helped to bring me incremental gains in mobility. I would later come to think of that time as a five-month journey around my room, often accompanied by my physical therapist at my side, as I sweated to graduate from wheelchair to walker to cane, with no guarantee that I would improve. As one doctor explained, "You've had Guillain-Barré twice, you've had several forest fires, and each time it's harder and harder to get healthy regrowth." Because I am a journalist by trade, it was in some ways inevitable that my personal journey into autoimmunity would turn into a professional quest. I wanted to know what was being done to investigate autoimmune disease. Why didn't we as a society hear more about these illnesses, both the problems they cause and research underway to combat them? What factors coalesced to cause autoimmune disease? Did environmental components play a role? And if so, what were they? What could a patient do to stem the damage and prevent future crises? Driven by an urgent need for information, I sought out answers from the top researchers in the field. It quickly became clear in talking to these cutting-edge scientists, however, that the story was far bigger. My own case was but one tiny part of an emerging global health crisis, one with disturbing and widespread implications for every American. During the same years that I have been waging my own battle with autoimmunity, researchers at dozens of top international institutions around the world have been documenting an alarming rise in autoimmune disease rates. Four decades ago, writer Rachel Carson, author of Silent Spring, demonstrated how our chemical age has altered our environment to the degree that the fertility and survival of many of the species with which we coexist are threatened. Then as now, there is great resistance to the idea that environmental contamination can alter the health of both animals and people. Indeed, it has taken several decades for many researchers in the autoimmune disease field to come to the conclusion that our contaminated environment is causing the human immune system to run amok. But the consensus is rapidly building. These pages lay bare this inconvenient truth. One is disturbing to today's top scientists is global warming. My hope is that the chapters you are about to read will awaken a deep understanding about how the environmental changes of the industrial age and our 21st century lifestyles are wreaking havoc with the immune cells of our own bodies. We are our environment. What we put into it, we also put into ourselves. What we do to it, we also do to ourselves. The way in which our bodies are turning against themselves when autoimmune disease strikes serves, sadly, as a disturbing modern analogy for what we are doing to ourselves as a society as we continue to dump thousands of chemicals into the soil, water, and air that surround us. Our mass dependence on chemically manufactured home and lifestyle products and our diet of chemically processed foods in many ways constitute a great societal health experiment, as we continue to surround ourselves with thousands of chemicals whose properties we do not yet fully understand. With our eyes open to that knowledge, we can begin to make critical and profound choices, embarking on a journey of small steps that will slowly start to make all the difference between health and disease. As we educate ourselves about the consequences of our day-to-day lifestyles and strive to make the personal, political, and economic choices to counter those ill effects, we will be taking back our environment, our bodies, and our future.
That's Donna Jackson Nakazawa. You're listening to Meet the Author on your NPR station, 88.7 FM, WBFO. Donna's new book is our selection to close out the month of June, The Autoimmune Epidemic, Bodies Gone Haywire in a World Out of Balance, and the cutting-edge science that promises hope. Donna, from the introduction, you talk about immune systems running amok, bodies turning against themselves. What's happening fundamentally in a body of someone who suffers from an autoimmune disease?
Well, an autoimmune disease is essentially something in which the body's own immune system, which is really meant to prevent us from harm and keep harm from happening, whenever any kind of bacteria or virus or pathogen or chemical comes into our body, our immune system sends out this cascade of different chemical messengers to determine, is it safe or is it foreign? And if it's foreign, it begins to mount an attack. In autoimmune disease, the system becomes confused. And rather than attack just the bad guy and take out that bacteria or defend against that chemical or that virus, it begins to make a molecular mistake and attacks the tissues and the organs and the systems of the body. In neurological autoimmune disease, that would be often the myelin sheaths or in the spinal cord with MS, different damage happening in the neurological system. In rheumatological autoimmune diseases like lupus and scleroderma, it can be different parts of the connective tissue or the organs of the body.
Is it common for the public to confuse HIV AIDS
Absolutely.
With autoimmunity?
Absolutely. And sometimes the acronym is the same. AIDS. Some people will use AIDS for autoimmune disease. But in AIDS, what's happening is that the overall immune system of the body is suppressed. It's not acting and it's not defending the body, and you're really susceptible to all kinds of diseases and infections. But in autoimmune disease, the immune system is tricked and is getting misfired signals and is overreacting. It's reacting too much.
You mentioned some of them in the introduction. Other common autoimmune diseases that we would be familiar with?
Type 1 diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, hypothyroidism, Graves' disease, scleroderma, lupus, Guillain-Barré syndrome, multiple sclerosis, transverse myelitis. There are over almost 150 that are also related.
Why are they so difficult to diagnose? You have a case study that involves two physicians in the book, and even with their collective knowledge and experience and the context that they had, it was very difficult to diagnose these diseases. What makes them so peculiar in that regard?
It's a compilation of factors. One, it's historical, and that is that while we were waging the Great War on cancer, we really didn't even believe that autoimmune diseases existed. There was a very charismatic Nobel Prize winner who declared that the body would never turn on itself. Horror autotoxicus. The body would have a horror of turning on itself. And this was accepted medical science well into the 1970s, even after autoimmune disease had been discovered. So we're late out of the gate, number one. And these diseases weren't taught in medical school until the mid-1980s. Think how that compares to the Great War on Cancer, which was happening decades before that. But in addition, the average patient sees six doctors over 4 years. Six doctors over 4 years, and that is because these diseases are difficult to understand. Symptoms can come and go. Flares can happen. It's very difficult until very recently to do accurate blood work. And much of the blood work that is being done now that's fantastic and can help eliminate other diseases and show antibody activity that points to a particular autoimmune disease is not available outside of top research centers.
And that discovery of the very concept of autoimmunity was actually revealed here at the University of
Buffalo. It was in 1951 by Noel Rose. It's a great thing.
When we look at the 23.5 million Americans who suffer from autoimmune disease, two questions. Is that figure more than likely low, and how does it relate to other illnesses that are affecting large segments of the population?
Great questions. 9 million Americans suffer from cancer, and yet cancer gets 10 times the funding of autoimmune disease. So it's an interesting statistic. 22 million Americans suffer from heart disease, and almost 24 million from autoimmune disease. So we get much more funding for diseases that affect fewer people. Most scientists also agree that because autoimmune diseases are not reportable diseases, by that I want to explain that for a second. That means that if you have cancer and the radiologist finds cancer on when he's reading the radiology report, he has to put that information into the SEER program. He has to say, this person at this place and time has this cancer, and this is it. If you were diagnosed with an autoimmune disease, we have no reportable system. That is not reported by a doctor. It's between you and your doctor, period. So most experts estimate that 23.5 million is a very low estimate.
When we look at the very concept of autoimmunity being born here at UB in the 1950s, how long did we have to wait before we had acceptance within the medical community?
Well, this is a wonderful theological and philosophical discussion of normal science. And it applies across all disciplines, but there is a kind of recipe for how long it takes for things that are absolutely against the accepted norm to become normal science, and it's 20 years. It takes about 20 years, and even then, as I said, it wasn't taught in medical schools. So scientists were talking about it in the 1970s, but they weren't teaching it. It still flew in the face of what had been accepted for so long that the body would never turn on itself.
And it was that mindset that was really only half of what you call a perfect storm. At the same time that we're dismissing the possibility of a concept of autoimmunity, also represents one of the largest segments of industrial growth in this country's
history. The timing was almost too perfect. At the same time that we were ignoring the idea that the body could turn on itself and fighting other diseases like cancer very, very strategically, or trying to, we were also mounting the greatest industrial revolution of all time in many senses. All of a sudden, we were developing flame retardants. We were developing plastics. And we were developing chemically processed foods. So all across America, you had big diesel trucks taking big loads of Spam and flame retardant. Spam, you know, who can forget? Velveeta cheese, all of it. Everything was coming out of factories, whether you sat on it, it was a cushion you sat on, full of flame retardants. These were all new to the American public. 80,000 chemicals with very little testing and zero testing as to whether or not they affect the human immune system, coming on the market at the same time that we didn't believe the human immune system could ever be torqued so that it would turn on itself.
You introduce a term in the book, the term autogen. We know that chemicals can cause cancer, but what is the current science right now? Is the prevailing mindset that certain chemicals can also cause autoimmunity?
We know from lab studies that certain chemicals certainly can turn the animal's immune system to turn on itself. Low doses of TCE, which is a VOC, or organic compound that's very volatile. Low doses of that have been found in dozens of studies to turn animals' immune systems against themselves. But we have a really large NIH study of 300,000 individuals over 14 years in 26 states, and people who worked with pesticides and a number of other chemicals were more likely to die of an autoimmune disease. So the science, it's kind of like where we were with global warming 10 years ago, where we were having scientists come out and saying, you know, this is really happening. Well, the science is mounting to the point that really scientists who might have said 5 years ago, are you sure, are becoming sure as well.
You're listening to Meet the Author on your NPR station, 88.7 FM, WBFO. We're talking with Donna Jackson Nakazawa, author of the new book, The Autoimmune Epidemic, Bodies Gone Haywire in a World Out of Balance and the Cutting-Edge Science that Promises Hope. BuffaloRising.com, the city's monthly print magazine and daily website, is proud to support programming on WBFO. BuffaloRising.com covers current events, lifestyle trends, and civic issues with local content that celebrates Buffalo and our citizens, available at retail locations throughout the city and also online at BuffaloRising.com. Donna, when we talk about pollution over the course of the night or as it relates to autoimmune, it's not just environmental pollution, but we're also talking about pollution within our own bodies. Is this what the CDC refers to as our body burden?
Yes, it is. It's our body burden. It's been tested by the CDC, Mount Sinai, the Environmental Working Group. And these studies have been repeated over time. And out of 116 chemicals that they looked for, they found traces of every single one. More frighteningly, more recently, in 2005, they looked at fetal cord blood, and they found 286 different chemicals in fetal cord blood. So we know that these chemicals are within us. And, of course, chemical industries like to say, well, maybe they're good for you. How can we know a little bit of benzene isn't a good thing? You know, can you prove it? And yet in Europe, one takes what's known as the precautionary principle, and that is that if we suspect it may be doing harm, if we have mounting evidence that it's doing harm, it behooves us to take it off the market until we can show that it's safe.
And one of the examples of that is phthalates, which have been banned all through the EU, have been banned in Japan. Is anything that's happening overseas affecting what's going on in the United States? Are we looking at what these countries are doing and asking why we're not following suit?
We're not looking at it in a serious way, but what's happening is that cosmetic companies have now two factories. They have the factory where they can then bring cosmetics out for the American market full of phthalates, and then they have the factory where they can take the phthalates out and put them into the European market. So it's caused some manufacturing headaches for people, but it doesn't seem to be causing any legislative headaches.
You mentioned Rachel Carson's Silent Spring in the introduction. Important to point out, DDT was banned in 1972, and a Mount Sinai study shows where every single participant in this study carried detectable levels of pesticides, including DDT.
Yes.
And it would be interesting to see how many of these people were actually under 35 years old that weren't even alive at a time when DDT was being used. Does our body have any way of breaking down these contaminants?
It's interesting you would ask because it depends on what the contaminant is. For instance, we know that PBDE, or flame retardants, has a shelf life of 4.4 years. Well, that would be great if you were never exposed to it again. Let's say you had one exposure, you bought all new carpets, and that lovely new carpet smell was wafting up all the time. And you bought a new car and a couple of other things, and you were full of you had flame retardants all around you. And 4.4 years later, your body would break it down and be gone. Not going to happen, because you're inundated with flame retardants everywhere you go, every day of your life. So even if there is a half-life where your body could secrete it, we're never given that time in modern society. And that, coupled with the fact that many chemicals that we're taking in, it depends on your genetic ability to break them down. We know with pesticides, for instance, that there are certain genetic subtypes that can excrete pesticides relatively well. But Caucasian people, in fact, have a more difficult time excreting. They tend to have a subtype of a genotype that does not allow them to excrete certain pesticides as well as some other ethnic groups. Now, it differs, and I don't want to get into ethnicity there because there are other contaminants that are more difficult for other ethnic groups. So it depends on a number of things, how constant your exposures are, what the half-life of that excretion, the time would be that you would excrete it. But in addition to that, who you are. Are you the canary in the mine? Are you the person who does not have the genetics to clear that toxin?
When we talk about susceptibility and the fact that we're exposed to these chemicals on a daily basis, some of us are genetically predisposed and by extension more vulnerable.
Right.
How does this all relate to what you call the barrel effect?
Well, the barrel effect, what I think of is that we're each like a barrel. And in that barrel, we can take in a certain amount. And if you've watched or a glass of water or a barrel, it rises to a certain degree. And then when that water hits the rim, one drop more, just one, will cause it to spill over. And much more than one drop will spill. In the same way, our immune systems are programmed to take quite a lot. In the time that Bert and I are talking right here, our immune systems have had to make millions of decisions about what's safe and what's foreign. It's such an elaborate and beautiful system. But when our immune system is overtaxed with too many chemicals, and let's say you're eating a diet that is very, very chemical, a lot of pesticides, a lot of additives, which our diets are full of, coupled with stress, and let's not minimize stress here. Stress is a chemical. The stress hormones that run through our body are chemicals. Added to that, any viral history that you may have, because viral history is also important in looking at one's possible likelihood of getting autoimmune disease. All those things together fill your barrel. And then it may be just one small thing, a particular virus at a particular time, or a particular exposure. And that immune system is like a barrel that cannot handle one more drop. It spills over and disease strikes.
We've already talked about funding disparities with autoimmune right. diseases. And I want to introduce lupus into the discussion here because it's going to play a larger role as we look at the remediation that happened on the east side of Buffalo. But is there any better illustration of just how great the funding disparity is with autoimmune disease and other chronic illnesses and devastating illnesses? When we look at drugs that have been developed for lupus over the last 40 years in terms of new development, what would we find?
Not one drug has been approved specifically for lupus. Other drugs are used off-label that have been developed for other diseases and are in use for lupus in that way. But for 40 years, no new drug was developed for lupus. That's changing. That's changing, and I write about it in the book, and it's changing for one reason. Lupus was for a long time considered an orphan disease. That means a disease that does not strike enough people to be considered worth a drug company's time. But as the numbers are growing, guess what's happening? Guess what's happening? The profits are there. 1.5 million Americans, and that may be well underestimated, are suffering from lupus. And as drug companies can see the profits coming, we are beginning to see a couple of drugs in development specifically for lupus after 40 years.
It's almost a form of social injustice, which we're going to again see as we talk about just what was happening on the east side of Buffalo. It's Meet the Author on your NPR station, 88.7 FM, WBFO. We're with Donna Jackson Nakazawa, author of the new book, The Autoimmune Epidemic, Bodies Gone Haywire in a World Out of Balance, and the cutting-edge science that promises hope. Support for our program this evening is provided by Eye Care and Vision Associates. Doctors Homewood, Lewis, Full, Gormley, and Matasati offer state-of-the-art diagnostic and treatment capabilities at four offices and optical shops. The phone number is 631-EYES, Eye Care and Vision Associates, Total Eye Care, Caring Professionals. Donna, from your new book, The Autoimmune Epidemic, perhaps there is no better place to examine the ramifications of waiting too long for irrefutable proof of the role that environmental contaminants play in today's autoimmune epidemic than here in the city of Buffalo, New York, where for far too long residents, researchers, and society looked the other way. We talked earlier about the EPA's website. It shows this area of the city to be profoundly contaminated, yet it was only a perceptive business owner who started asking questions that got things going. What did Betty Jean Grant first notice as she was working in her store?
Well, I'm hoping that she's here tonight because she's a pretty amazing woman.
Betty, are you here this evening?
Did she make it here? She was going to try. Betty Jean Grant ran a little store, and she noticed over a period of 14 years, that more and more young women were coming in within a very small couple of block radius, and they were becoming ill and dying of lupus. And she noticed a pattern where a number of them all lived on one street or one street over, and she decided to get to the bottom of it. She actually started by calling the city of the water department and was told to stop making conspiracy theories. Then she decided to run for city council, and she did. And as happenstance would have it, right after she ran for city council the second time she won, a paper crossed her desk, and it showed that in 1997, and this paper came across her desk in 2000, so 3 years after this initial investigation had happened, it was found that there were areas on 858 East Ferry where there was lead ash 2 feet deep. 2 feet deep and that had been sitting there for 3 years. And furthermore, nothing was going to be done to clean it up because the state superfund was all belly up. So this began a series of events that happened in Buffalo that were quite extraordinary. But they started with one woman in the community standing there and saying, why are so many people getting sick in such a small area? It didn't make sense.
There was no response from the city. There was no response from the county. In fact, I think both entities were too busy trying to argue over who should put up a fence around the lot. But you look at this. There was eventually a coalition that was organized, and Betty Jean was one of the people responsible. They tried to get a handle on these numbers. And the only way to do it was by going door to door. Over two streets, just two streets in this neighborhood, 17 cases of lupus, 37 cases all told by the time they had canvassed the neighborhood. And this didn't include the people who had yet to be diagnosed or the people who had already died from the illness. And for all the alarming realities that you bring up in the book, one of the most disturbing are these two very simple sentences. No one cared. No one was paying attention.
Absolutely true. And it's another case of environmental injustice where, because this area was economically underprivileged, no one had really noticed how sick people were becoming. And luckily, a group of people, and I know one of them is here, Judith Anderson.
Judith, where are you?
She's right over there.
Judith.
Started a local coalition, and just a very small group of them. How many of there were you at that time? Three or four? In the beginning, got together, I guess, about once a month at a local bookstore and started talking about what they could do. And Judith and a number of other people who weren't being paid a dime ran off copy sheets, put them in the nearby housing projects that were in the area, warning people that there were 2 feet of lead ash in a field and there was no fence around it. Not even a fence that would keep people from going in there. At that time, small children were going into play. People were growing pumpkins in the fields. And people had no idea what was happening and that this was actually a toxic waste site that the city and the state had known about for 3 years.
Donna, are autogens and carcinogens mutually exclusive hazards, or can a substance that acts as an autoimmune trigger also be a cancer?
Absolutely.
Causing?
They're both functioning on the immune system. One is making the immune system. An autogen is something that makes the immune system overreact, as I said. It loses the ability to tell friend from foe and begins to attack the body's own systems. And in cancer, certain things we know to be both carcinogens and autogens. Certainly, we know, you know, with pesticides that that can be the case and a number of other things. But in cancer, what happens is it triggers the overgrowth of cells. So one agent can be both, but we've tended to only think of it as carcinogenic.
One of the things the coalition would realize in this neighborhood is that the contamination was not limited to 858
That's
East
right.
Ferry. There were other sites as well that posed equally great dangers.
Absolutely. It was kind of an Orion's belt of contamination throughout the area. There was also on Delavan, also, I think 537, I hope I have that right. There was also another toxic waste site, and there was a third one as well. And if you look across the map of Buffalo, and I certainly, you know, have it in the book, where you can just see these three places where very little had been done to clean up over a very long period of time. And people were living in a community completely and totally 100% unaware of any of the three of them.
When we talk about the site at Delavan in particular, there were 10 individual 10,000 gallon tanks that were leaking contaminants into the ground.
Right.
How is it that the EPA declares this an inactive site?
Well, because they felt that these tanks that were buried under the ground, and some of them were above the ground, that no one was going in and out of the area. And so, therefore, the site was safe. Unfortunately, they were full of volatile organic chemical compounds, which we know can live in the atmosphere for a long period of time. And so even after they did go in and decide to clean up the area, some of the testing showed that levels had only gone down by half, and in some tests were higher than they were before remediation happened. So it's a difficult, and I don't want to blame anyone, because it is so difficult to remediate those things in a careful way to really get rid of volatile organic compounds. But what is amazing and startling is that it took so long.
10 years.
Cleanups are very difficult to do, no question. But they're a lot easier sooner than later.
How does the university get involved in this remediation? What was the role of people like, is it John Vina?
John Vina and Joe Gardella. Joe, are you here? Yay. Well, what's amazing, and I report on a number of toxic waste sites around the country, and I've, since the book came out, investigated a few others. But what's really extraordinary to me about Buffalo and the Buffalo story is the community story. Here, some people, some citizens like Judith, were just concerned from the bottom of their hearts what was going to happen to their fellow citizens. Why were so many people, particularly women, getting sick? And they invited John Vina, who was then at the University of Buffalo, to come to a meeting, and he said he would try to get involved. And then as things got a little tougher, and it was a little harder to get the state to take any action because they were blaming the city, and harder to get the city to take any action because they were blaming the state, they then went to a professor of chemistry at the University of Buffalo, Joe Gardella, and they asked him to do some testing. And he came up with some results with his chemistry team, and I guess, did you have a group of graduate students with you? And they came up with something that was really so irrefutable. And again, this is just good works on the part of people in the community, both at the university and living their day-to-day lives, coming together and putting together a portrait that no one could continue to ignore. And that's where Joe came in with bringing that chemistry work and bringing it together with what people had been saying by then for several years. And finally, you know, the two hands met together. We had community activism and the actual science to show that this simply could not stand.
You're listening to Meet the Author on your NPR station, 88.7 FM, WBFO, with Donna Jackson Nakazawa, author of the new book, The Autoimmune Epidemic, Bodies Gone Haywire in a World Out of Balance, and the cutting-edge science that promises hope. We're into the last 15 minutes of our discussion. I'd like to get the audience involved right now. If you have a question for Donna, please go ahead.
Yes, first of all, I just want to say I'm so impressed by your research with your book. I just finished reading it, and you were so thorough, and it was such an education.
Thank you.
You talked about type 1 diabetes, and that now it's 80% that they can determine that you will be predisposed to it. But my question is, what would be the answer? You don't want to start the drugs. These drugs that you take for these diseases are more likely to kill you than the disease itself.
Right.
What would someone in that position do, I mean, besides regulate their diet and try to stay away from processed foods?
Excellent question. And this is the thing. As we begin to have better and better testing for some of these diseases, those are very tough questions that have to be answered by a patient and their doctor, one person at a time. Let me just step in, though, and say that that kind of testing, that sophisticated testing for who's going to have type 1 diabetes or who is developing what you might call the drum roll pattern for lupus, this is so sophisticated, and it is not available to the average person. This is being done at research institutes around the country. It's very expensive testing. So it's unlikely that any time very soon will a patient be able to find out that they are in that situation where they have an 80% chance of developing type 1 diabetes. However, type 1 diabetes is a disease that runs a very strong genetic component. So there is that a patient can look at. If one were, hypothetically, to go through that kind of testing and find out that they stand at the cusp of developing a disease like type 1 diabetes, they would certainly want to look very deeply at the dietary and stress components. Would one want to start a drug right then? Probably not. But these are situations that would have to be taken one patient at a time. It's so difficult to answer.
Thank you.
Donna, talking about type 1 diabetes, there's also some extraordinary research that's being done, research that's led by Dr. Denise Faustman. What is she doing, and what makes her work so groundbreaking?
It's astonishing. It's astonishing, and it's, again, a case of normal science. Here's a scientist at Harvard who decided that she thought it might be possible to attack just the errant immune cells that are attacking the beta cells in the pancreas. And she decided that she wanted to try doing this. She did it and succeeded to a great extent. And all the other scientists in her field came out and wrote papers against her and laughed at her and said she was just full of it. Well, they then tried to replicate her studies, and guess what? She was right. She was able to do this, and she was doing it in animals, and she then was lucky enough to have Lee Iacocca come and give her $11 million. Because he felt that it was pretty provocative research. This does not happen in science very often. Every researcher I know would dream. Joe, how would you like Lee Iacocca to come drop $11 million in your lap? It doesn't happen. Funding is so dismal these days. So she has been able to do that. She's now looking for patients to come into her trial. I've been able to hook some patients up with her, and it's a very exciting research. Over time, she's been able to help the pancreas by eliminating these errant immune cells. And let me clarify. By that, I mean she's just taking out the bad guys, as opposed to a lot of autoimmune therapies, which just suppress the entire immune system altogether. She's just isolating these bad guy T cells, getting rid of them, and the pancreas regenerates. It regenerates. This is new science. This is the future, and it's very exciting. If we will fund it, there are cures for these diseases if we will fund it.
And another remarkable development that's happening that's being led by Dr. Douglas Kerr is one that I hope you'll touch on before we go to another question.
Absolutely.
From the audience.
Yes, I'm an elementary school teacher in the area. I've been teaching young children, 4-, 5-, 6-year-olds, for about 15 years. And my informal observations are telling me that I'm seeing a lot more hyperactivity and especially inattention
right.
in young children.
Right.
I know mercury has been linked to learning disabilities. I was wondering if you could, you know, share any other information you have.
I would say that every teacher I know agrees with you, and they would also say it's the four A's. It's autism, allergies, asthma, and autoimmune disease, and ADHD, five A's. Isn't that odd? They all begin with A's. But teachers around the country have commented on this. We certainly know the statistics with allergies and autism are actually much better documented than they are with autoimmune disease. Mercury is a specific contaminant in the immune system. We know we have a very large body of research that shows that mercury is something that tampers with the immune system. I write about it a lot in the book. Mercury actually can bind with our cells and create a kind of third cell that the body recognizes as foreign. The top work on this was being done out at Scripps by some very profoundly brilliant people. Whether or not the mercury is coming from our environment, you know, mercury comes out of, I live in the Chesapeake Bay, and mercury just pours out of the Ohio Valley it rises out of the Ohio Valley, comes across in certain weather patterns, and it can be documented that it is just literally pouring down into the Chesapeake Bay area. We also, I know people want to know about vaccines and other types of ways in which mercury works its way into the immune system. However it's working its way in, whether it's fish we eat, there are some fish we know are very high in mercury, like swordfish and tuna. We're getting too much of it. And is it one of the factors that could be contributing to these 5A diseases rising so exponentially? I believe it can, certainly. The science is so difficult to do because we like to see where is it happening in the human body. We want to take a room full of school kids, and we want to say, see, there it is, right there. That mercury is making him inattentive. And until we can do that, until we have a tobacco where we literally see people just falling down dead from something. We don't want to mess with taking it out of the market. We don't want to talk about it. And it's a very serious thing in this country that our proof, our system of proof, is so unmet. We can't meet the burden of proof that we pose in this country. And until we do, we're waiting for another lead. We're waiting for another tobacco with all of these other chemicals. And by then, I want to know what's going to be happening in your classroom. What are those kids going to be like? What are we doing to our kids?
You're listening to Meet the Author with Donna Jackson Nakazawa, The Autoimmune Epidemic, Bodies Gone Haywire in a World Out of Balance, and The Cutting Edge Science, which we're discussing now, The Cutting Edge Science, which promises hope. Support for WBFO is provided by Eye Care and Vision Associates, Drs. Homewood, Lewis, Full, Gormley, and Montesanti offer state-of-the-art diagnostic and treatment capabilities at four offices and optical shops. The phone number is 631-EYES, Eye Care and Vision Associates, Total Eye Care, Caring Professionals. When we talk about cutting-edge research and all of the remarkable research that you detail in the book, I was just really floored by what Dr. Douglas Kerr is doing. It's just absolutely extraordinary on two levels in what he's accomplished and the fact that, anecdotally, I have found no one that is even remotely familiar with this research.
Doug is an astonishing man, and he is a genius on the planet, and I'm lucky enough to go around and do a lot of talks with him. And he has been able to take rats who are paralyzed with diseases that mimic Guillain-Barré syndrome, transverse myelitis, and MS, and ADEM, all neurological diseases in which the myelin breaks down. And he has been able to come up with a growth cocktail, a number of different agents in stem cells, feed these stem cells into the neurological system of these rats, and I have seen the rats in the lab. They cannot walk, and then they are what I call in the book robo-rat. They are running around their cages again. His next stage of trials is in pigs, and then he'll work his way to humans, because obviously the length of a neurons have to go so far in a rat, and a lot longer in a 6-foot-tall man. But what Doug would tell you if he was here is if we can get the funding for these diseases, in 10 years, we will see a cure for these diseases. We will see people walking who have been in wheelchairs. And I've sat in rooms with 400 or 500 people in wheelchairs, all of them. And it is something to sit in an audience and watch him talk about his research and show the film of these rats. And for these people to think in 10 years they might get out of a wheelchair, or their daughter might, or their son might.
You know, it's the idea of the paradigm shift that keeps coming is the recurring theme of the book. When you look at Doug Kerr's research, you know, skeptics are saying that neural pathway growth is confined exclusively to the fetal development stage. When we look at the concept of autoimmunity itself, when we look at examining the triggers, repairing the damage, all of this requires us to think in an entirely different paradigm. And it doesn't seem that we're doing it, despite the fact that we have so many reasons to think differently.
Every single scientist who's breaking ground in these areas is making a complete paradigm shift. It's kind of like the guy who discovered that ulcers were infections. Remember that? You know, everybody laughed at him for a very long time. And so many times, people are run out of science because they're saying the one thing that no one else believes could be true. No one believed Doug Kerr that this could happen, that you could regrow an adult neural pathway. Could only happen in utero. So what are we missing here? What aren't we asking? What is the question that we aren't asking about these diseases? Luckily, we have scientists who are working hard all over the country to figure out what the unasked question is. Could we just get rid of certain T cells and the pancreas would regenerate? What a question. Could we introduce a new neural pathway in the body in an adult? What a question. You know, and now we have to start coupling those questions with why aren't we funding these people? Why aren't we helping them? And why aren't we looking more into what the environmental triggers are and the chemical triggers through our diet of autoimmune disease? Why are we afraid to ask these questions? And it's more than whether or not we're willing to take a paradigm shift. I think it's because the answers are really scary. And they make us each one of us as an individual have to ask very different questions of how we live. And that's what makes it so hard.
You're going to have to step up to the microphone, please. And we'll get to your question in just a moment. We're into the last 5 minutes of the show. Donna, we do have that failure of imagination and then the failure to invest to come up with the new answers. Before we get to a question from the audience, and again, we're into the last 5 minutes of the program. If you do have something you'd like to ask Donna, I encourage you to go to the microphone. When we look at possible causes, we keep coming back to pollution. Right. But there is also a school of thought that says the world may be too clean.
Great,
as well.
Yes. Absolutely. I'm so glad you asked that, because talk about normal science and talk about paradigm shifts. For a long time, the very convenient answer to why are rates of these diseases going up has been what's called the hygiene hypothesis. Anybody heard of it?
Yeah.
Okay. The hygiene hypothesis holds that we're not living in a world that's too dirty. We're living in a world that's too clean. Our immune system becomes educated over time to fight all those foreign pathogens, those millions of things that are in this room right now. Well, if our immune system isn't getting educated, if we're driving our kids around in minivans and they're not out there mucking around in the swamps, are their immune systems becoming educated enough to fight off the different things in the environment? And do they become kind of like bored teenagers that then overreact or want to, you know, get hyped up too quickly to do something too fast because they have been undereducated? The new body of science on this is so fascinating. It's showing that the hygiene hypothesis really cannot alone be an answer for these epidemics. We love the hygiene hypothesis because it tells us we really can't do anything. The world is too clean. What can I do? It's such an easy answer, and who would rather say your world is too clean or too dirty? We don't have time to take a poll, but I know what I'd rather think. But in fact, new science is coming in, and it's showing that, interestingly, the hygiene hypothesis doesn't hold water. Immigrants who come to this country who have lived very, very dirty, mucky lives, who haven't had all the immunizations that we've had, so their immune systems haven't been shown how to be undereducated, and the science on this is so complicated. Nevertheless, they come to this country and they develop autoimmune diseases at the same rates as Americans once they live here. Mm. This and a number of other studies are calling into question the hygiene hypothesis, and not saying that it isn't true, but that it alone cannot account for these rising rates. And a group of people at Hopkins, at Johns Hopkins, Delisa Fairweather, is a genius in this, and she's leading the research trying to reshift the paradigm away from the hygiene hypothesis, because as long as we hang everything only on that, what action can you take? What can you do about that? It gets us off the hook, and it makes us lazy.
Donna Jackson Nakazawa, our Meet the Author guest, discussing her new book, The Autoimmune Epidemic, Bodies Gone Haywire in a World Out of Balance, and the cutting-edge science that promises hope. From the floor, please, your question for Donna.
Yes. Are you familiar with the connection between fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome and the immune system?
Absolutely.
I have lived with chronic fatigue syndrome for about 17 years, and I sort of have my ups and downs. But doing some reading, I did read somewhere that it was in fact connected with autoimmune disease.
Absolutely. What they believe is that chronic fatigue has not been shown to be autoimmune per se, in that every autoimmune disease has an autoantibody, or an antibody that's meant to protect you, that becomes an autoantibody. That literally means an antibody against self, auto meaning self. There is no known autoantibody in chronic fatigue syndrome that I know of. I'm waiting for someone to call me and tell me that there is. But what they believe is that with fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome, the pathways are very similar in the immune system. And so many of the different things that cause these diseases may indeed be the same. And you will see that people with autoimmune disease very, very frequently suffer from chronic fatigue and or fibromyalgia. They seem to run together. So we know the pathway in the immune system is very similar, but the answers aren't all in.
Okay, thank you.
Donna, as we close and we talk about protecting the immune system, as you read in the introduction, we are our environment. What are some of the best ways to protect the immune system?
I think the best thing that you can do is hold on to the analogy of the barrel and think to yourself, don't get too scared. The barrel can handle a great deal. And the worst thing is if you run around all of a sudden wanting to look for your bubble suit, as my husband always accuses me. Let's get your bubble suit. There is no bubble suit. There is no bubble suit. So that gets a little too frightening. What you can do is think of your immune system as a barrel. And when you think of it that way, it isn't that you're trying to empty the barrel out completely. It's an impossible task. When you know many chemicals have a half-life of 4.4 years, where would you begin to do that? You couldn't find a safe place to completely empty out your immune system. What can you do to take the water down below the lip of the barrel? It is absolutely essential to think about your day-to-day choices. There's no reason now not to be cleaning green. You can easily find green cleaning products. There's no reason not to be using safe cosmetics. I give all the websites in my book. They're very easy to find, even just on the internet. There's no reason why you shouldn't be thinking about a hybrid car. There's no reason why you shouldn't be thinking about a stress relief habit. We didn't go into it, but stress chemicals, we know, act on the immune system as efficiently as many chemicals in our environment. So coming up with a daily stress relief habit is clinically, in clinical studies, makes a tremendous difference for autoimmune disease patients. But the thing I would urge you to do foremost is to clean up your diet. The research coming in on how profoundly our diet is linked to our immune system health is absolutely stacking up every day. And a number of major physicians at major hospitals are starting to think about putting all of their patients on an anti-autoimmune diet or an anti-inflammatory diet. There are things that rev up our immune system. There are things that break down our immune system and make it more likely for it to run amok. And there are things that strengthen our immune system. A large proportion of our immune system is in the gut. It is in the gut, and it's there that so much of these diseases can begin. So I think of diet, make strategic purchases. Don't put all new carpeting in your home. It's really not good for you. These are common sense things. If it stinks to high heaven, it's probably not good for you. If it's a food that comes in a package that could be left out on a shelf for 2 years, it's probably full of chemicals to keep the roaches out. Just think common sense and empty the barrel and relax.
You're listening to Meet the Author on your NPR station, 88.7 FM, WBFO. Our selection this month, Donna Jackson Nakazawa's new book, The Autoimmune Epidemic, Bodies Gone Haywire in a World Out of Balance and the Cutting-Edge Science that Promises Hope. BuffaloRising.com, the city's monthly print magazine and daily website, is proud to support programming on WBFO. BuffaloRising.com covers current events, lifestyle trends, and civic issues with local content that celebrates Buffalo and our citizens, available at retail locations throughout the city and also online at BuffaloRising.com. I'd like to thank WBFO's general manager, Carol Petro, along with Dave Benders, our program director. Our production staff tonight included David Chandler, Mike Kerwin, and Kyle Kryzak. Our pre-show music from Joe Girano and Doug Margano. Thanks to John Welch at Talking Leaves Books, BuffaloRising.com, one of our co-sponsors, along with iCare and Vision Associates. This evening, Meet the Author is also made possible in part by a grant from the New York Council for the Humanities, and also made possible by the generosity of your membership support. Again, I'd like to thank UB's Joe Gardella for introducing me to this book and helping to arrange Donna's visit this evening. I'm Bert Gambini. Our producer is Kelly Bocock-Natale. Again, thanks for listening to your NPR station, and Donna, thanks for visiting with us here in Buffalo.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure.